And we're live with our 298th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host, Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Excited to be here. As always, we've got a fair bit to talk about. Feels like there is always a fire going on in NPM lately. And yeah, just news in general, there's quite a lot happening in the security space. So always something to talk about. Before we get into it though, I did want to mention that we do have the Harnessing LLMs course available. If you were looking for this course, we will be teaching it in October. I think it's the 9th and 10th or 8th and 9th. Training.absoluteappsec.com. This is your opportunity. We had some people reach out, if we're going to run the course, we need people obviously to sign up. So would love to have you there. This is a reprisal of the course that we taught at DEF CON. So with all the latest and greatest that we are implementing within AI and how we are using AI to actually drive AppSec tasks. So that's October, and we also will be doing an extended Black Hat version of that course, Next Level Secure Code Review, or Next Gen Secure Code Review, I think is what we called it. But it's a combination of both Practical Secure Code Review and Harnessing LLMs, 4-day course at Black Hat Europe. This will be December, I think it's 8th through 11th. In London. That course is filling up. So if you would like to take it, if you would like to spend the days learning about AI, how to use AI, how to do secure code review, how to build like these tools out, please consider us and sign up now. Outside of that, Ken, this episode is going to be sponsored by DryRun specifically. So we're going to talk a little bit about DryRun's latest feature and their MCP server. I was going to turn it over to Ken to actually demo some of that before we dive into some of the articles and other things that we have to talk about today. So Ken, yeah, you want to take it away?
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. And I wanted to share this because it's like, basically, this doesn't exist, right? Like, this isn't something that has existed yet for security teams. And so that's why I really wanted to talk about it. Yes, it's my product. And of course, yes, I want to talk about that. But what I think is really interesting is the capability this unlocks. So like, everybody talks about how they have an MCP server. And usually when it comes to like code software security tools, what those things do is allow you to grab like stats around your vulnerability data or whatever. This could do that, sure, but this is actually tied into a lot more. So for instance, like the whole background behind this was kind of like when I was at GitHub, we had a security review process, a releases process. Those two were tied heavily together. And they were great for like large feature ships or large new services and things of that nature. But a lot of stuff just never sees the light of day, right? And we don't even know about it until after someone submitted a bug bounty for whatever the new thing is. That's just the reality of most security teams' life, right? So as we were building out our product, as we've evolved, one of the things that we surfaced this pretty early on is that, hey, we have a capture, we're capturing every change happening everywhere all the time, right? So what we ended up doing was surfacing that information for security people. So what I mean by that is like, when you go in here, you can see that I've got this, you know, this is connected to our Insights MCP server. It's got a few different organizations I've said that it's authorized to access. I'm actually choosing, the DryRun Sec org here. And the first thing I asked was just like, tell me about the most interesting changes that have happened within the last week from a security perspective, right? So some of the things it starts talking about is like, hey, we have a new deep scan feature rollout. And I can always like ask which PRs that happened in, and it'll show me all of the pull requests that made up that new feature. I can ask about who shipped it, what risks existed in it, what functionally changed. I can dig in so deep everywhere and just have instant visibility into everything going on, right? This one's true too. AWS Marketplace integration. Yeah, we added some new callback handlers for AWS Marketplace bits there. Some additional NLCP improvements, refactors, things of that nature. And then I said, just tell me about interesting things in general, things I might be surprised to know, right? So then it gave me some eyebrow raising discoveries. So we did actually put in a bypass for our scanner. It's actually to do no ops, but it is good to know that that was there was an option added to disable those types of checks in the scanner. Mock vulnerability data shipped. This is all true. Of course, that was more for staging wiring of things, but the gist of it is that it does understand, you know, the sort of big things going on inside of my organization and what risks, kind of exist there. So it gives me some thoughts as to, with each one of these, it kind of talks about things I could do to improve my security. I've asked, I said, what are the coolest new features we've shipped? And it can tell me about sort of those cool new features and things to be, things to think about with each one of those. There's a lot more that we can do, right? So we could say like, which PR author has shipped the most risk this week, for instance, right? I can build charts on the fly. I can build graphs and grab metrics. I can correlate data together. The long and short of it is I can interact with my code. I can get information about statistics related to, what are the types of things that I'm introducing and where am I doing that at? Code velocity. I can even correlate velocity with risk. There's so many things as a practitioner that this really gives us. And so, yeah, sure, it's my product, whatever. And yes, we're sponsoring, so I'll talk about it. But it's not for, I'm not really talking about this. Like, I'm not bringing this up just to promote a product. I'm trying to explain that, like, in this new world where we're leveraging AI and automation around AI to manage our programs, we are uncovering like new capabilities that just they never existed. How else would you have figured out what was shipping? How else would you have figured out? And I mean like everything that's shipping, even small, discrete, like little Git patches where one line of code changes somewhere, right? That just didn't exist, Seth. I mean, that's why.
Yeah. This has always been it, right? Like we've talked about this for a long time. Like people have like GitHub Actions that they build to like stop dangerous things, or even I think back to the days that when you were at GitHub trying to monitor like all of these different projects as they go out the door. There's only so much time that anyone on the ProdSec or the AppSec team has to review PRs, right? Or to review patches as they go out the door. So having this ability to just historically look back quickly and answer these questions is pretty incredible. I mean, like the way that I'm looking at this is very similar to initially how we were looking at the AI assistants built into Windsurf and into Cursor, Copilot, that you could ask questions about a code base, right? Like have it actually go do that. But now you're expanding that out to, hey, the full organization and everything that's going on and changes over time. So not just the static look, because we could always go in and do IDE searches for various things. But when those dangerous actions happen, this is the sort of thing that becomes invaluable. Like it's not necessarily only a ProdSec function at this point. This is something that the monitoring team, that the SOC is probably going to start, is going to want insights into, right?
Right. Yeah. Well said, by the way. No, you're absolutely right. We're seeing engineering leaders use this. It's just, I don't know. It's like, it blows my mind what we're finding and surfacing to people. And this was the one that just sort of, to your point, actually, about the like code fixes in Cursor, one of the videos that Pete on our team made internally was actually using this insights to locate the riskiest PRs, drive down into why they're risky, and then actually used, and this was all, I think, within Cursor, then use the IDE to go, I think he had a GitHub MCP tool installed as well. And so then mm-hmm. he just had it mitigate the vulnerabilities and submit PRs for it and automatically yeah. assign essentially, you know, a bot to go fix those, and then reviewed whether or not the fixes made sense. They did make sense. So it was really cool in like seconds to see him identify the riskiest PRs, assign a bot to go fix those, and then validate that the fixes actually worked. Very, very cool stuff. So anyway, it's yep. just a new capability that, like I said, keep building on top of, but I thought it was just so cool. I had to share this one. You know, I don't talk about all of our features, but this one was important to share. It's really yep. big deal.
It's sweet. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, like, you've probably seen it if you're on LinkedIn, like it's been promoted, but if you haven't, go check it out. Think about how you could actually use that in your pipeline. I mean, that's part of the reason that we've been teaching the course. Like, it's this, we see these capabilities with AI, and we're layering things, you know, AI on top of AI, on top of manual effort, on top of like checklists, atop of pattern analysis, and the ability to pull it all together and actually operationalize things is what we're teaching, what you're building at DryRun, what we're starting to do from a dynamic perspective as well at Redpoint. So it's just this, it's pretty exciting from an overall security and application security perspective, because I know I've said it multiple times, but it feels like a superpower, right? What used to take me 2 to 3 days to do, I'm now doing in 15 minutes with the use of some of these tools, which is pretty awesome.
Heck yeah.
Heck yeah. Well, good. What article do you want to dive into? You want to do some of the basic stuff? Do you want to talk about the dumpster fire that is NPM and all the attacks going on?
Yeah, we should get that one out of the way, I think.
We should get it out of the way because it's becoming a weekly, weekly feature, I guess, or a weekly discussion on the podcast. And this one is actually from Paul Sixmile on Slack. Shout out to him and his team for identifying, or at least like breaking this down, this Shai-Hulud NPM attack. The one thing that I didn't get on this, and I want you to speak to it, right, is the avenue for takeover, right? And I don't think they call that out. They don't know right now exactly how the NPM account takeover happened, but he has not responded, at least to Paul and his team, on what actually happened there, which is fairly interesting. But did you want to talk through the actual, like, I'll actually share that screen really quick if you're on the YouTube channel or on LinkedIn, you should be able to see this. So this is from Paul. But basically what there's 54 packages that, you know, this Scott yeah. Cooper has controls, but some of these are fairly popular, right? Yeah, I mean, I've seen Killer 2 show up recently, right? Like that one, like a lot of these are. Dang. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I had to
tiny color package. You did have to put out a
message on it. Sorry. They're just saying, like, I had to message everybody and be like, hey, we're not updating right now. No NPM libraries are getting updated at the moment. And of course I shared internally with everybody what's going on, but yeah, it looks like you said, a developer with, I don't know, something like 38 significant packages was compromised. That person doesn't seem to know how they were compromised. At least they didn't at the time of the writing. All of this is so new. Today's September 16th. The blog posts I've seen linked have either September, I think all of them. Hold on. What is Paul's?
Yeah, it was like 13 hours ago, right? Like it was pretty recent. I think it was last night. Right, like, or early this morning, depending on where you're at on the globe, where this actually happened or was identified.
Yeah, exactly. So this was, yeah, this was really, oh, so September 16th, AEST. That explains it, Australian time. Okay. So, right. So like I said, the author was compromised. It sounded like it was a similar thing where the libraries search for credentials. The thing that's a little interesting is they seem to add workflow files for GitHub Actions and then use those GitHub Actions to, if I'm not mistaken, exfiltrate secrets. And oh, sorry.
One of the interesting things that I saw, or I was thinking about on this one, is this use of Truffle Hug, right? Like it actually downloads Truffle Hug and uses that to identify valid credentials, as opposed to just trying to go pick up ENV files, like some of those other techniques that were used in previous malware. This is using legit security tools subversively, right? Like in a malicious manner. But yeah.
Yeah, it's like so they sorry, yeah, exactly. So then those right, so the tokens get stolen. There's a bash script that identifies if it finds a GitHub pat, it will identify the repository access for that GitHub pat and use the GitHub API to create a malicious branch in the repos that it has access to. And it will, in that new branch, inject a new workflow file. So essentially a new GitHub action. And then that workflow will exfiltrate any secrets that are available to the, it says webhook.site endpoint. I'm not sure what that, but I assume like really what matters here is that the GitHub action actually exfiltrates the secrets, right? Yeah, I mean once you have GitHub, once you've got GitHub token secrets, you can act on behalf of that person essentially, and it gets pretty nasty. And so the idea is like it's a hands-off worm, right? Meaning like somebody. There's that initial compromise, but now everybody else will just install that NPM package, have their secrets exfiltrated. If there's a GitHub pat, they'll have a GitHub branch created with our new workflow that will further perform exfiltration. But I think the idea is that it's self-propagating, so it will ideally identify, you know, credentials that allows us to overwrite other NPM packages and just continue this chain of, you know, this it's a worm. It's just continue this exploitation of packages on NPM. So that's why I say right now, like I think the best course of action is probably just pause builds for the moment. That would be like potentially one way to handle this. I mean, I don't have the ri like I'm not comfortable with us updating any libraries at the moment at all. So, you know, that's my risk.
Well, yeah, it is, right? Like, and I don't know. After last week's or a couple weeks ago episode, like, so when the initial NX security compromise happened, I was looking back at previous episodes that you and I had done, and actually one of them was predictions for 2025 around supply chain security, right? If you go back to early this year, we were talking about supply chain security and how exploits were going to happen. And this falls right into the predictions that we had, right? Attackers were going to start to use AI to actually do some of this identification, that they were going to up their phishing game in order to target specific individuals, including those that had access to popular packages. And once they would attack those, like they could build malware quickly. They were going to start exfiltrating data. Everything that is going on here feeds right into the narrative that we've been spouting for the last couple of years around supply chain security. I don't know if there is a good fix for this because these are trusted accounts, right? Like from an NPM perspective, the maintainers are trusted. NPM's kind of done what they need to do in order to secure authentication. But I don't, yeah, like what is your strategy here, Ken? Right? Like outside of what you've done as far as like, hey, we're not going to update packages for a while, which also feels dangerous, but not as dangerous as getting completely compromised. What is your strategy?
I would say pausing until NPM feels like they've got this under control would be important. Yeah, I mean, I'd probably, are you talking about like if I'm NPM or if I'm an internal entity or, because if I'm an internal entity, I'm going to go back and look at my build logs and find out what's been updated recently for NPM and, you know, take a look if it's in that list. But even still, I'm like, you know, this is a worm, right? So it's going to compromise other packages. I do find it interesting. They went after CrowdStrike. I wonder if that was just a target of opportunity kind of thing.
I imagine it is, right? They identified, were able to get access to a maintainer because it doesn't, I mean, it looks like they just basically pushed to every package that they had available that was in NPM. If you're looking at this list and, you know, that I'm sharing right now, those versions that actually went out. Somebody's saying that, a VS Code plugin at some point, right? Like, so I don't know. Pausing seems like a good strategy if you're internal to a team. Robert's point about credential handling in isolated compute environments, even in dev, start to make more sense just to limit the blast radius of some of this. If you are a maintainer, that's probably something you should be looking at is, yes, it's more work, but man, like when something like this happens, if you can limit the blast radius to a single package instead of 30, 40, 50 packages, that would be ideal. But it is going to be more overhead for you in those cases, right? To actually sign packages and everything else that goes along with that. Yeah. I don't know. I don't have a good solution, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's got to suck to deal with this today. I mean, if I'm NPM, this has got to be just an annoying. Well, I will say last week when we talked about this on the podcast, you know, sort of like we did call out, hey, this was, you know, an attack for crypto mining purposes or like, you know, stealing crypto wallet credentials kind of thing. But I know that we called out like, hey, this could get a lot worse. There could have been a lot worse. And I feel like this week they're like, well, let's make it a lot worse. This is how you do it. I mean, this is pretty terrible. I mean, it's almost like, do you just temporarily disallow people from updating, or at least people who host popular packages, like if they reach a certain threshold? I mean that genuinely. Like, do you just say, okay, look, for the time being, you know, quick pause until we can get enough heuristics that tell us, you know, when something's being updated, likely that it's being updated by these nefarious actors or something of that nature. So,
yeah, I'm wondering if they're, you know, like to Robert's point, right? Like, you know, this is our job, right? Like definitely to like think about these threats and handle them as they come down the pipe, especially as a product security application security person, right? Or engineer for an organization, whatever it is. There's no easy button here. I think from an NPM perspective, that's probably what I would be pushing is, okay, there's a certain threshold that when a package gets so popular, anytime a new package is built, there's going to have to be some MFA. There's going to have to be something else, some other check that actually happens to make sure that that push was intended, especially when the downloads are that, when they cross a certain threshold. I feel like that's really the only thing. I mean, we've talked about MFA for other things. We've talked about signing, right? Like, okay, so if your account gets compromised and you can push a new version out via GitHub or whatever it is, then maybe there's got to be another gate from NPM that is making sure that that package was intended, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we talk about it for high risk actions inside of web apps where you re-credential people, make them jump through hoops. This would be no different. You know, I mean, that's, you know, that's how GitHub works, right? You go to delete a repository. It's like, hey, first of all, put your MFA back in, right? I need to know this is you who's about to take this action. And then they ask, you know, not so much of a security thing, more of just like a making sure you didn't do it accidentally. Then they ask you to type out the repo name or the NWO in order for you to further validate that you mean to do that thing. So like adding in a couple additional steps might not be fun, but it may be very, very necessary to prevent this type of thing in the future.
Well, and actually that kind of speaks to that simple article that I shared across to you, like the layered security approach, right? But it's not always implemented, but can be a great security control, right? Like, and this one's pretty simplistic. They titled it security through intentional redundancy. Robert, that's a great solution as well. So before I get into this other article, right? I don't want to, you know, it would be nice if package.json understood that unless there was a signed commit that you don't actually install a specific version of the package. There's some tooling that needs to be built into that. But as an AppSec person, it does feel like that's, you know, again, that's something that we've got to monitor, and we're going to have to figure out a response it sucks, but it's on the client to actually do instead of on the server right now, because that's where cleanup is going to happen. Yep. Okay. So going back to security through intentional redundancy. Anybody that's looked at code is going to notice this gaping security hole, right? Like, so this is Golang, I believe, yes. Basically, this is like deleting a photo out of the database based on an ID. This is classic insecure direct object reference. Once you have that ID parameter, whether that's a GUID value or a number, if you have it, you will be able to delete that photo. No questions asked, whether or not that you are the user that's associated with it. So pretty classic insecure direct object reference, broken access control finding. The approach that he talks about is actually adding the owner string to the call itself and making this a standard coding pattern for any retrieval or any especially sensitive data manipulation. And you and I have talked about this for years from a broken access control perspective, and we are getting back to kind of the crocs and socks, the basics of security with this. But a lot of this goes back to coding patterns. And I mean, security through intentional redundancy, this photo already exists. It already has user object associated with it within the database. And the query is redundant by putting that user ID parameter on there. The thing that it does give us is that layered security approach, right? So things like these NPM packages, like making sure that they're signed, that's layered security. Making sure that the maintainer is the one that actually signed that package, making sure that they have jumped through the necessary hoops in order to push that package, re-authentication, reauthorization. Like, yes, those are not necessarily the most efficient ways to go about implementing security, but they do save us in situations where things go wrong or someone is maliciously targeting your application. So in this case, right, the user ID value is being pulled from the request object, which is actually set up when a user is logged in, right? Like there's all of these different like parameters. That's not something that's manipulated or manipulatable by the user, that ID parameter associated with the user within the session object, that request object it comes from the database directly, comes from that authentication process. So that deletion will only happen if the user is already authenticated and is associated with the ID parameter. I realize it's pretty simplistic, Ken, but it feels like a good kind of going back to the basics of, hey, we've got to approach this from a layered security perspective.
No, yeah, to dumb it down, totally. Yeah, I mean, to dumb this down, it's basically like, hey, and the first function is like somewhere before we call that before we invoke the deletion of that record somewhere, because we're going to call this function, it's going to delete a record, right? Mm-hmm. We got to pass an ID to this function because it needs to know which record to delete. And presumably, somewhere before we called that function that's going to delete a record with user supplied input, we've done some sort of authorization, presumably. And we hope that our authorization not only validates that you are allowed to access this endpoint, but hopefully that it also validates that you're able to access that record. That's the dumbest way that I can say it, right? And then what they're saying in this very simplistic example is no. Instead of just calling a function that takes an ID, make it take also a user object. Because at that point, inside of that function, we can scope to say, hey, this is the user, and this record is supposed to belong to this user. We can scope that record call and protect it. And the whole point being that you, when you invoke that function and you're just passing those two things, an ID and a user object, you never, even if you screw it up, who's going to go and try and like allow looking up a user object first and then saying, okay, well, like meaning who's not going to use the session to your point, right? Who's going to instead try and jump through hoops to get a user object that it can then pass to the function? Nobody. They're just going to be lazy and say, use the current user, right? Or whatever the Golang equivalent in this case is, just user, right? Mm-hmm. Because that's, to your point, already accessible to them. Middleware has already decided, you know, through some other process that this is the user, and that's something we should be able to just go by, and that's secure because it's a server-side generated session, right? Yeah. So they're basically they're saying like, even if you do nothing and there's no authorization ever used, you still get security by default. And that's a really smart way to do it. And you know, yeah, it is a simplistic example, but I understand the whole point. If you're designing for carelessness, not to say that those are actual attributes of the person who's writing the code. I'm not saying that. I am saying if you're designing for those things, then you're going to be in a good spot.
Mm-hmm. Well, it kind of goes back.
Things are awesome and efficient and not lazy, then
mm-hmm. you probably aren't running into this situation, right? Like if everything is, but yeah. But you know, it always goes back to those the guardrails, right? The secure design, like the paved path idea. If we just design like these functions to be secure in and of themselves or require that redundancy, developers are going to use that. And like one of the things that we've started to do with clients actually is provide cursor rules or, you know, Windsurf rules like Claude desktop or Claude code rules for various functions as people are coding, right? Like, and this is a good example of a pattern that you could introduce pretty quickly into those LLMs, right? LLM, the IDEs driven by LLMs or utilizing LLMs, providing best practices on how to actually do lookup, how to build SQL statements, how to prevent injection or perform authorization, perform, you know, any of those typical patterns that you should see should also be in those LLM instructions, so that the developers get that notification earlier. Like make it easier for them to implement something securely than to just go to the lowest common denominator. And that's all I was calling out with this. It was just a really good, like, simple example of what we see on a daily basis when it comes to insecure direct object reference and the broken access control that yeah, we should be able to take care of in a fairly routine manner.
It's always the like authorization that gets applied, like it's divorced from the object that's being modified or deleted or updated in some way, right? So, or created or whatever. So what I mean by that is like, it is a very common pattern to have authorization decorators that broadly apply to say, I'm going to use controllers, even if we're not talking about MVC, just controllers to represent exactly that. Things that take HTTP, basically things that take an HTTP request and are going to like do something. They're going to either call a model and update a record, or they're going to return a file or some JSON or something, right? And so what you usually see is an authorization function applied inside of those where it's like I said, broadly applied. It's not about any specific object. It's usually about figuring out who you are. If this has elevated permissions, like an admin portion of the application, do you have those kind of permissions and whatnot? But then what you and I see, and I think a lot of other people listening see, is that there's some additional logic that will happen. And if that additional logic doesn't take into account the individual records that are being modified, and which often is the case, then you're going to have BOLA, IDOR, whatever you want to call it, type of authorization flaws. And so it is nice to see a sort of like, there's the front side middleware before you even get to the controller authorization. And then within the controller, it calling functions to do updates, whether that's in the ORM or somewhere else, which then has its own set of isolated concerns about that specific object. And inside of the function that is responsible for updating, there is some sort of mechanism for validating that the actor updating the object match up authorization wise.
Yep.
Bit of a mouthful, but it's just all I'm trying to say is like authorization before and then authorization almost after, if that makes sense.
Yep. Well, it's all about that layered security approach, right? And then making the correct choice, the easiest pathway. And that does, that does feed into this other article from Frankly Speaking, right? That is actually Maya Kazarovsky, I think is how you say her last name, right? This was a guest post on Frankly Speaking a few weeks ago from Maya. And she talks about the new commandments of security, right? He reached out to her to talk about specifically what she was seeing, like the shift in mindset to scale, to actually succeed, and lessons that she's learned that aren't yet widely adopted. One of those, if you look through, actually, let me share my screen really quick again. New commandments of security teams, right? And so this isn't just AppSec, but it is very like, kind of AppSec focused. But one of these is actually, secure development is the default path. Yeah, so number six, delegate authority, not just tasks, allow people to actually choose like the secure choice, or at least make that the easiest choice. But also allow them, give them the flexibility to actually dig into other things. I don't know, like if you're looking at this, and we don't necessarily need to talk through the paved paths anymore on this, but if you were looking through these new security commandments as they have been coined, what is it that speaks to you, Ken? Like, what is it that you... that you would be interested in or want to discuss?
Well, I'm going to take three. So
okay.
Start with number three, which is fixed classes of problems. We've had several guests on who have talked about this, and I've talked about how we did this with cross-site scripting and other issues at GitHub, where you just focus on a single problem, the category of issue that you face the most. And you just hone in on that. So, all right, to that point, maybe it's like making sure that you've got some sort of policy enforcement or rule enforcement that says I can't have my content security policy modified. Maybe it's also ensuring your content security policy is really, really locked down. Maybe it's cookie isolation between your different properties. Maybe it's a new library that you're gonna have people use for, I don't know, processing text or text to HTML or something, so that everybody's using a single unified library that you can, if something's discovered that goes wrong in it or if it needs to be updated, then everywhere it's updated all at once, and you know, all applications have the benefit of that new rendering library or whatever it is, right? I'm just making things up, but taking multiple approaches to solving one single class of issue makes a lot of sense to me. I won't go into the other two in as much depth, but I'll just say that like usability matters is absolutely true. And I think what they say, which is like, it's not just that you want people to use something and enjoy it and that'll make things more secure. It's actually you're trying to prevent people from going outside of whatever guardrails or whatever specific solution that you put in place, and them finding workarounds that are just way more dangerous than, you know, the way they were doing it before that you were trying to prevent against. And then I guess like prioritizing vendor reviews, I feel like that actually is very personal to me right now. I was kind of like stuck between number two, which is your security problems aren't unique to your organization. I think that's totally true. You're trying to over-engineer and you're like, whatever. But like prioritizing vendor reviews is personal to me because I've had to submit for so many vendor reviews, right? Like I'm going through all these different sales procurement processes right now. And so I'm filling these out, and I've got another person helping me that fills them out. And it's just, I sit there and I wonder sometimes like how the other side is receiving this, if it's useful. And I think they talk about how people like pretty much get stuck in the, or sorry, she talks about how people get stuck in the mud on like, you know, basically paperwork. Like, like everything was filled out to the length that I want. And, you know, is it like, no, this is a meaningful thing that I'm actually going to really put some decent, and it's not just a check in the box, and it's not just me making sure they filled out all the right things. It's actually prioritizing which risks matter and how would I want those protected and what vendors are going to have access to those systems, right? That's probably the more, like just prioritizing who you're even going to have go through these reviews. And then based off of what you know they're going to touch, that's when you really delve down into like their answers and make sure that it makes sense. But if it's just like, well, we had 100 vendors come in and all 100 went through their paperwork and they filled out every section correctly, then it's like, what use is that? So I'm curious, like whether it's that or any of these other ones, what sticks out to you?
Vendor reviews always stick out to me, right? Like I like this idea of actual prioritization there, because you know, as a services company, the number of reviews or questionnaires that I fill out that have no bearing on what we are actually doing is somewhat ridiculous. You know, like, yes, like what you should be concerned about with me as a third-party services provider that's identifying vulnerabilities or looking at your code is, one, how am I going to protect that code when it's in my, like, on my system, right? But realistically, do you really care about what my like AWS infrastructure looks like if your code's not going to end up there? No, right? Like, why am I answering questions about password and account rotation on, you know, within a cloud environment when the code and what I'm doing for you has no bearing, or that has no bearing on what I'm actually providing to you? So that prioritization, that it's just paperwork at some point. So like that does speak to me as well, because I've spent so much time filling out that sort of documentation. But you do, like, it's very relevant to ask about updates on systems that where that code's going to be hosted, where we're going to like be identifying those vulnerabilities, how we're going to interact with your endpoints, right? Like that is what you should be concerned about. So it almost feels like there needs to be like some there's not a catch-all list that applies to every single vendor that you have, right? And that's where, you know, it kind of gets back to the, what is the other one? The one that you called out, your security problems aren't unique to your organization, right? Yes, right, like your organization is bespoke, your code is bespoke, but everyone is solving the same problems in slightly different ways. So whether it is like how you're implementing authorization in your code, whether it is how you are doing endpoint validation or endpoint protection, everybody's got some way that they're going about it, what sort of VPN they use. And like that feeds into usability as well, because the harder that you make security to overcome, the more likely that your customers and your employees are going to look for the easy path to bypass that security, right? So you've got to recognize that there's got to be some sort of usability that goes into it. The other one that I did, yeah, the corporate security is real security. We're seeing this being taken advantage of, especially developer desktops recently. Developer IDEs, environments are being targeted. Think about what we just talked about with NPM, right? Developer accounts are being compromised. So yeah, if that system is not up to date, if that one is not being monitored, we can no longer carve out administrators and developers from corporate security. There should be no exception. There may be a different build. There might be some other like monitoring tools that are in place. There may be different requirements for them, but those have to be monitored. Vendors, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely do.
Yeah, that was kind of where I was going. I was just looking at that comment from Robert as well. What did you want to say to that? Sorry.
Oh, just agreeing with you that, yeah, like it's, I mean, you know, that's why when it came to like entitlements, and, I mean, just getting Okta in place and like for SSO everywhere and then having like entitlements run through a joint IT and security sort of operation was hugely helpful. And yeah, just make sure that people aren't using, you know, the same password for every website kind of thing. And yeah, it's I don't know. I guess I'm just agreeing that IT and security are intersecting quite a bit now and should, and that our IT controls. And I know this because I work so heavily on the both IT and SOC and engineering side and, you know, everything else, but you know, those specifically like security, engineering, IT, compliance, those are all within my wheelhouse, and they're all connected to each other. Whether it's a policy that gets set for IT impacting SOC 2, which then, you know, impacts like, and that policy will impact obviously meaningfully our security posture in some way or another. It's all connected, right? So
yeah,
trying to be like IT, what was it at the, what did they say in the article? Security, I think at some point they said like security used to set the policy and IT would enforce it, but that's just not the way that it kind of, you know, should go anymore.
Yeah, I think that's where it was, right? Yeah, yep. Old model of security sets policy, IT enforce it, falls apart when the systems need expertise in both areas, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, we're seeing that crossover things. I mean, it came up in the NPM attack, but Truffle Hog and other places, like the way that we're actually pushing code and where those secrets end up, like all that comes into it. The other line that I really liked from this was under usability. This security needs to serve everyone. Your security tools need to be usable by the intern, not just the senior security engineer. And specifically in prod security, and AppSec, I think about junior developers need to be able to understand what, like how to implement things securely. And they need to be able to use whatever mechanisms you've come up with. It's one thing when you've built a library, you've built a process that works for the security or for the senior engineers. But we've got to create our process and our tools for that lowest common denominator. Because if we don't, then we're never going to get over the hump with the full team. And they're not going to learn that until later on, which means you're going to produce more insecure code earlier in people's careers and all of this that, you know, kind of runs into it. Let's see. Results matter. Yeah, that's great. Yeah. All right. I'm looking through this list again, if there's anything else that I wanted to call out there specifically, anything else that you want to address when it comes to that list?
No, but while we're here, I do want to just briefly mention something else on the podcast because Pete, so while we were on this episode, Pete, who I work with closely, has shared this link. Let me put it in here. And if you're not familiar with PNPM, so Papa November, Papa Mike, PNPM, it's like NPM. It's built on top of NPM, but it's like a faster, more efficient package manager installer for NPM. But one thing that's really interesting about that is that they added new support for delayed updates of your dependencies. So now you can set a time. So like if a new version of a library gets pushed, you can say, I want X amount of time between when that new library was pushed and the time that I update it. The idea being obviously in cases like today and last week where, you know, all of a sudden your build systems are maybe, because you have to remember a lot of these libraries that were attacked were at least last week. This week I didn't do as much digging yet, but at least last week they were very, very much transitive dependencies. So meaning like most of the time, these weren't libraries people were necessarily installing directly. They were installing some other library that just required that library. Why does that matter? Because if that parent library that required that library is updated, then you're going to, and you haven't like pinned, and why would you, that sub package, right? You're going to go ahead and just update to the latest version of that sub package. So in this case, what you're saying is if you just set a delay, then, and to be clear, like, especially in last week's situation, it was about a 3-hour window. And if you had updated during that 3-hour window, you'd have problems and otherwise you would not. And so this would totally fix that type of issue where you would have, if you, let's say, delayed it for a day, you wouldn't have updated to any of those insecure dependencies. And the next day when it was all triaged and figured out and fixed, you'd be safe. So I do think this is a pretty cool enhancement that PNPM released. Thank you, socket.dev, for mentioning it as well.
It feels like the notification, the monitoring of NPM has definitely increased over the last year, right? Especially from third parties like socket.dev, like safety, what is the name, right? Like there. getsafety.com where Paul's at. Like there's a lot of people that are actually watching that ecosystem. So the attacks, when they happen, are being identified within a fairly reasonable amount of time. Now, like reasonable can be disputed depending on whether or not you were actually hit. But this is a good way to get around it, right? Like, hey, guess what? New packages just have a 24-hour hold. Or, right, like if you really feel like a need, like even just like a 12-hour hold would probably be better than immediate, right, after things get released. Cool.
Yep.
Yeah, that's a good call out. And this is a good strategy to use. Again, something to put in your back pocket to implement. Take a layered security approach and be reasonable about it. No one's going to scream if, you know, they do have to wait half a day for a new package. And if they do, then you have other mechanisms to actually deal with those sorts of issues. Cool. Well, good. We're at 11 o'clock. I know we had one other article that I guess we'll put into the newsletter. And this is also a notification for anyone that's not signed up for the newsletter. We do post a summary of the episodes on a weekly basis. They go out usually on a Friday, and have other articles that we don't get to during the podcast that we will post in there, as well as a couple other items and related episodes. So check out absoluteabstract.com, sign up for the newsletter if you have not done that up to this point. But yeah, anything else you want to call out today? Are you going anywhere else from a...
So next Monday, this Monday coming up, 22nd, I'll fly to Vegas for, again, for Enterprise Tech Leadership Summit. It's held at the Fontainebleau in Las Vegas. So I'll be there working a booth for 3 days. So it'll be 23rd through the 25th. Then I know next month, give me one sec to figure out the dates on this one. I believe I'm going to, it's not even next month, it'd be, it's like the following week. But anyways, I think I might be going to this HUSETCon. It's in Houston, September 30th through October 1st, maybe. That'd be not this upcoming week, but the following week, it sounds like. But anyways, so I've got a couple weeks of busy travel coming up and then back to normal. But, yeah.
Cool.
What about you?
Well, B-Sides Cache Valley was last week, or B-Sides Cache, right? There's a B-Sides Red Rocks that's actually in St. George. It's about an hour or so outside of Vegas, close to Zion National Park and a few of those other national parks down in southern Utah. That's in November. Prior to that is actually SaintCon. I'm helping run the AppSec community at SaintCon this year. That's the same week as LASCON, sadly. So I always have to kind of pick and choose, but I've been helping out build up the local application security community. So I'll be there. And then just Black Hat Europe is the next big thing. Like that's the next big travel for me outside of like small client visits here and there. But along those lines, Ken, that means that we probably won't be recording an episode next week if you're going to be at ETLS. So
that's a good point. I probably will not be able to do next week. Just a reminder, because you called it out at the beginning of the episode, people reached out to us to put the Harnessing LLMs course out there. That wasn't our idea. I have reached back out to you all to let you know that we put the course up there. So go ahead and sign up. Obviously if no one signs up, we'll just move the course, but you all asked for it. So it's up there. So go ahead and sign up now. I did it. We did it. So
we did it.
Otherwise
it's available for you.
Yeah. The course. So just heads up there.
Yeah. We do need a certain minimum to actually sign up for it in order to make it worthwhile. We will have some announcements along those lines as far as like an online version of Practical Secure Code Review and a couple of other things that we are working on in the background right now. I know we've talked about it a few times, but we do actually have a platform and we're moving along to instrumenting that and operationalizing, making it available. And so that should be coming here fairly soon as well. If you want to do a hands-on version of that course or a self-paced version, I should say, that will be available. Cool. Well, yeah, with that, I think that's everything for this week. We're going to be off next week, it sounds like. And if something changes, just watch Slack, join the community there. We'll continue the conversation today, especially around the Shai-Hulud attack that's been going on in Slack for the last few hours at the very least. Interesting patterns to actually analyze and watch. Yeah. Otherwise, I think that's everything for today, Ken. Thanks everybody for listening and interacting. And we'll see you all soon.
Thank you.